KBOO 90.7 FM on the broadcast dial in Portland, Oregon, USA, and KBOO.FM on the World Wide Web is pleased to present the entire proceedings of the Biodiesel Conference held in Portland, Oregon on October the 23rd. From 12:30 in the afternoon, the opening remarks, through the town hall meeting, which adjourned at 4:15. The only editing has been the silence of a 15-minute break. During intermission, we cut out the silence. This is Glenn Owen for KBOO Public Affairs on the Web.
Hello, I'm Andrea Lewis, the Creative Director for Energy Element. Our mission is to fuel solutions. Energy Element is a nonprofit dedicated to promoting alternative fuels. As a vehicle for innovation, Energy Element energizes the movement away from petroleum through educational and outreach services. We support sustainable markets where the cycle of returns is visible within our community. We have a beginning segment as biofuel introductions. I'm going to be introducing Paul Needham and also to be introducing John blanks at names. Got Don Wysowski. Got on the opposite order. Don Wysowski is an extension soil scientist with Crop and Soil Science Department of Oregon State University, Columbia Basin Agricultural Research Center at Pendleton, Oregon. He's conducting educational program and applied research on soil, water, crop management, and dry land crop systems in the semi-arid Pacific Northwest. The goal of his extension publications and educational meetings is to integrate research results into a whole farm management system. He cooperates and works with the USDA and state agencies to develop and implement public policy on conservation. Since 1987, he has conducted research and developed agronomic recommendations for canola and other new crops. He's worked with producers, extension agents, natural resource conservation services, personnel, agriculture consultants, and soil and water conservation districts to get research informed into the hands of farmers and other users. All activities have been targeted to meet producer needs and to present information that is practical, financially sound, and scientifically credible. His education and research efforts have focused on developing cropping systems that improve farms and resource sustainability. This includes integrated research on tillage, fertility, residue management, rotation crops, and diversification of crop systems. Then following that, we're actually going to have Paul Needham. Paul Needham is a native Oregonian. Paul Needham grew in Lake Oswego and graduated from Oregon State University. He is the principal of Critical Marketing and strategic marketing firms specializing in helping software and sustainable businesses. Paul is a founder and board member of the Sustainable Business Network of Portland. The Sustainable Business Network is an alliance of locally owned independent businesses, community organizations, and individuals. He's working on building a more socially, environmentally, and financially sustainable local economy. In fall 2004, Sustainable Business Network launched the Think Local First marketing campaign, which encourages buying from locally owned independent businesses. Now, almost 300 businesses are participating in the campaign, and underwriting sponsors include Kitchen Caboodle, New Seasons Market, Powell's Books, Rejuvenations, and Storables. More information about Think Local can be found at www.thinklocalportland.org. Thank you very much. Correction. First speaker is actually going to be Mitchell Hartman. Mitchell Hartman is an editor of Reed College's quarterly magazine and was the editor of Oregon Business Magazine from 2001 until earlier this year, September 2005. Prior to moving to Portland with his family in 2001, he lived in Los Angeles, where he was a reporter, editor, and producer for Public Radio's Marketplace program. He has covered business, labor, economic development, energy, and workplace issues at several regional newspapers on the East Coast and has been a foreign reporter for Pacifica News and the BBC in Europe and in the Middle East.
Thanks. It's definitely fun being visionary. For one thing, you get to come to the Expo Center on a Sunday. You get to look at cool cars, listen to country music, get a solar massage, apparently, in the parking lot, which is where I'm going after this. You may remember a few years back, two scientists thought that they had invented the be-all and end-all to answer the Earth's energy needs. It was called cold fusion. When I was a producer at Marketplace Public Radio, we did a little skit to envision this future of a cold fusion-powered world, and I'm going to play it, assuming that the play button works.
Today, we drop in on the Smiley family having breakfast in their cold fusion-powered ranch home in Sunnyvale Estates.
Joan, this coffee is wonderful. Hot the way I like it, not too bitter.
Well, Jim, ever since we fusionized the kitchen like the Joneses next door, it's really hard to make a bad cup of coffee. Why, the coffee maker stores up cold fusion energy right from that jar of water by the faucet.
And when's the last time we paid a Con Ed bill? I'll tell you when. March 23rd, 1989, the day Pons and Fleischman discovered cold fusion. Why, we've saved $2 trillion as a nation on energy since then.
Giving us the money to save Social Security and fix the nation's schools. And do you remember how surprised little Stephanie was when her toy train started to run without the battery inside?
Where is she?
Up on the roof, observing the mist on the mountains through her telescope. You remember the science fair project about global cooling? Here come the kids now. Brandon, honey, please don't play with your Fusion Tendo at the breakfast table.
Oh, Mom.
And did I see you playing by the gasoline pumps over on Fleischman Boulevard yesterday, young man? Those old Exxon stations are dangerous.
What is Exxon? And what is gasoline?
Gasoline, a distilled byproduct of petroleum, like coal and natural gas, now obsolete.
Okay, wouldn't it be lovely if Exxon and gasoline were ancient history? Just imagine it. We could end our dependence on fossil fuels, get to the grocery store, heat our homes, power the entire economy with some earth-shattering invention like cold fusion. Of course, unfortunately, there are no quick and easy fixes, at least not yet, especially not with elected officials running the country who don't even believe global warming is actually happening. And a state legislature in Oregon that seems more often to be beholden to well-connected polluters. What it's going to take to save the planet from our own profligate energy use, our consumption and our carbon emissions, and consider that Americans use 25% of the world's oil, is slow, steady, piecemeal, transitional, interim measures, all adding up to meeting and hopefully exceeding the greenhouse gas reductions called for in the Kyoto protocols. Those protocols, by the way, the Bush administration refuses to adopt, and yet some leaders in this region, our governor and state legislators and city councils and mayors throughout the Pacific Northwest, are trying to achieve them anyway. There's one great idea, one idea that we can do today and tomorrow without waiting for genius scientists and venture capitalists and an actual, real, genuine national energy policy, and that is to put biofuels in our cars and trucks and to build an industry to grow and distill and pump and burn it right here in Oregon. It may not be as glamorous as cold fusion, but you in this room and others around this region are the pioneers, the early adopters, in one of the key global strategies, short-term, to combat global warming. So what are biofuels? I can tell you that they don't smell all that bad, and I know because as a reporter you have to do a lot of weird things. One of them, in my case, has been standing right behind the tailpipe of a car and inhaling deeply. You do all sorts of things as a reporter. There are two main categories, ethanol, made from corn, and biodiesel, made from all sorts of vegetable oils. In Oregon, it would probably be canola. The key is, and Paul Needham, who's going to speak after me, is going to talk about this. They're made from things we can grow and that we do grow right here in Oregon. Depending on just how expensive gasoline gets by the end of this year, Oregonians will send between $3 and $4 billion to oil company CEOs and shareholders, to Saudi sheiks, to the Venezuelan national oil conglomerate. If we could keep even a fraction of that money here, paying farmers for their vegetable oil and distillers for their biodiesel and Kettle Foods for their used potato chip oil, we would just start to begin to rebalance the scales in what is now a terrible imbalance in Oregon's trade relationship with the world. Not to mention, we would strike a decent blow for the environment and for true accounting of the real costs of oil. The $4 billion, of course, that we're going to send abroad to pay for oil this year doesn't pay for the real cost of using fossil fuels. You know, it doesn't pay for invasions and for military occupations in the Persian Gulf. It doesn't pay for spilling and then cleaning up oil in the Gulf of Mexico. It doesn't pay for, begin to pay for melting the polar ice caps. We all know that biodiesel and ethanol aren't the final solution for global warming. They're just a small part of the interim answer. But transitional fuels are crucial. As it's been explained to me, basically, carbon in the atmosphere warms the planet. We need to do two things to stop that. First is simply use less oil. Use hybrid cars, compact cars, use diesel vehicles, trucks or cars that simply use less gas, and they get better gas mileage, and you put less carbon into the environment. Possibly even more important in the long run, we simply need to get less of our carbon from deep, deep down in the earth. Any carbon that we can burn to get around that comes from trees or plants is released into the atmosphere, it's reincorporated into plants, and it's reburned again. It's a small cycle. Pulling new carbon from deep down in the earth, from under Kuwait or under the Siberian tundra, adds new carbon to the environment. Anything we can do, and biodiesel and ethanol are great short-term solutions for that, to stop pulling carbon from deep in the earth, putting it into the atmosphere, and warming the planet is good. I don't want to leave the impression that this can be done fast enough or that it can be done without government. I recently was speaking to an economist at the University of Texas, James Galbraith, who has looked at things like the space program, other national policies of a grand scale. And I asked him, you know, can the market alone generate the changes, the supply chain changes, the technology that will end global warming and turn off the carbon spigot? It was a short answer. He said no. What he pointed out is that the internet didn't come just from entrepreneurs. You know, the polio, eradication of childhood polio didn't come just from drug companies. All of these things need government to get involved. Unfortunately, in Oregon and in the nation, we haven't had a tremendously great track record in the last little while. We have President Bush's energy policy, energy bill, which I've renamed the Fossil Fuel Producers Protection Act. It's got a little bit in there for conservation and technology, but not a lot. In Oregon, the legislators had two great opportunities to strike a blow and push this whole industry forward. There was a biofuels bill that would have promoted biofuels in the state, and there has been a long-term effort to get Oregon to sign up to the low-emission vehicle standards that California has adopted and that Washington will adopt if Oregon adopts. If that happened, we'd have a fuel-efficient block of car and truck buyers from British Columbia to Baja California. The biofuels legislation, unfortunately, didn't make it through the legislature. Corporate lobbyists, Associated Oregon Industries, blocked that by trying to put a pollution control tax credit into that bill. The governor never made it to the governor's desk. And the governor has told the Department of Environmental Quality to implement the California low-emission vehicle standards in spite of efforts largely by the auto industry and the car lobbies, the car dealers, lobbyists, to try to block them from doing that. Aside from being here, if you do anything to jumpstart this, I'd say call your legislators, call your lobbyists, and tell them to get off the dime and do both of those things the next chance they get in Oregon. All of that said, Oregon is still an awesome place to do the biofuels thing. And it's a great place to pioneer this effort nationwide and worldwide. Paul Needham is going to join us and tell us why.
As Mitchell's made clear, this truly is a case for thinking globally and acting locally. I've been asked to focus on how acting locally can strengthen the local economy, can in fact create jobs and make for a more livable Oregon and a more livable metro area. The Sustainable Business Network of Portland has been actively involved in the concept of recirculating dollars in order to strengthen the community. The global economy that we've seen develop in the last 50 years and that is accelerating is going in the opposite direction. It used to be that a lot of the trade that occurred within a region. Now, increasingly, products are being shipped throughout the entire world, products which could be produced here and are being replaced by products that are shipped from elsewhere because of advantages, for instance, in labor costs. So we launched the Think Local First campaign, which talks about buying from local merchants. And there are studies that show just buying from local merchants, services and products will recirculate up to three times as many dollars into the local economy, because the local company will tend to buy their CPA services. They will tend to obviously hire more local headquarters staff. So just where you buy something can circulate up to three times as many dollars into the local economy, regardless of whether the product came from here. Obviously, it is even more effective if the product is produced here, the product is processed here, and the product is distributed here. Okay? And that's what we're talking about with biofuels. So one of the reasons that Oregon has a good opportunity is that all of those things can happen here. Let's have a little question. How many people in the audience think that Oregon, either offshore or somewhere in Oregon, has significant oil reserves that can be tapped? We got one guy out of the whole audience here. I've never heard anything about it. I've never heard the oil companies say it. I've heard nobody gearing up to do it, and even if there are some, it's going to have no significant impact. In other words, we're not going to have any amount of oil reserves that will make us independent of what the global oil markets are doing price-wise. All right, let's try it again. Our president and his administration, particularly after the hurricane Katrina and Rita swept in and did damage to the oil refineries down in the Gulf Coast, says it's very important that we build new oil refinery capacity in the United States. So how many people in the audience think that there are going to be oil refineries built in Oregon? We got one. Okay. Different one, by the way. Well, frankly, Oregon is not very friendly to toxic oil refineries, so we're probably not high on the list of places that you want to go pitch it. But economically, since there is no infrastructure here for it, it's not very attractive. So it's highly unlikely that we're going to see Oregon become a major oil-producing or processing state. Right. Given that, if we continue to use oil as we have, and I mean petroleum, then every dollar we spend is going to be, as Mitchell said, shipped out of state. We have a little bit of distribution, but we have no role in the actual product, and we have no role in the actual processing. That said, in 2004, Oregon consumed 1.42 billion gallons of gasoline and 502 million gallons of diesel. So all of that took our money and leaked it out of the region. Okay. Now, we also talked about when you're faced with something that you don't produce and that you're paying heavily for to import, you've got a couple things you can do about it. One is you can reduce your usage of it. For instance, you'll hear some talk today about land use planning and getting denser communities with light rail systems. I came out here on the MAX. I moved downtown from Lake Oswego about 4 years ago. I walked 9 blocks, got on the MAX. I sold my second car. I signed up for flex cars, so when I need a car, I just walk half a block and rent it by the hour. So there's a bunch of things you can do in the metro area that reduce the use of gasoline. The other thing is obviously to find replacement for it, and that's what we're here talking about, biofuels. One of the things that is very doable right now is to replace our use of petroleum products with biofuels. Now, what's exciting is that Oregon does have the ability to create a closed-loop biofuels infrastructure. You know, it's not like we're a desert state. We can't grow canola oil here or canola seed. It's not like we don't have dense metropolitan areas and areas where the distribution is very easily done. And it's not like we don't have a history of environmental activism and independent thinking that make us able to do things that other states won't necessarily do. Okay. And frankly, I should have said that when I talk local, local is as local as makes sense. So sometimes Pacific Northwest region is what you should think about as local. Sometimes it's the state of Oregon. Sometimes it's your local community. Whatever makes sense as to if I can do this here and keep the money here, then that makes sense locally. So it's not like Oregon should say, well, I'll never do anything that helps Washington. This is a region, and certainly regional independence is important to us. Now, you haven't heard me talk a lot about environmental issues. They're there, but really I think the important thing is the opportunity for Oregon to create jobs and create wealth. And what's interesting about this, I told you I took the MAX. You remember that the first attempt to have a north-south MAX line was defeated, and it was defeated primarily because of Vancouver and the rural voters in Oregon saying, what's in it for me, right? And there wasn't anything in it for them. There was no benefit. It benefited globally and benefited in the metropolitan area. Biofuels isn't like that. So we're talking something that both rural and metropolitan area can benefit from, and I mean economically. Now, is there any proof of that? Anybody done anything anywhere? The case that I hear quoted most often is Minnesota. So in 1997, Minnesota passed a law that required all gas sold in the state to be blended with ethanol. The state now produces over 400 million gallons of corn-based ethanol a year. The estimates that are produced in studying the net annual benefit to the state of Minnesota is that it has a net annual benefit of $580 million a year in the state. Okay. As of July 2005, building on that success, they are now requiring that 2% of all diesel sold in the state be biodiesel. And you can guarantee that they're going to produce that biodiesel in Minnesota. Okay? So it's not like some hippy-dippy, enviro-green state like Minnesota is showing us up, but they are. They're doing it for economic reasons. You know, they're doing it because it's good for their farmers and it's good for their ability to control their destiny in the state. We heard our cold fusion presentation. Frankly, I feel somewhat the same way about waiting for hydrogen fuel cell technology to save us. How many people in the audience think within the next 5 years they are going to buy and drive a vehicle powered by a hydrogen fuel cell? Oh, we got a couple. Okay. All right. Most of us think that we could walk out, buy one of these diesel-fueled vehicles, and switch to biodiesel today. So there is a chance that after billions of dollars of investment, hydrogen cells will show up in vehicles in the 5 to 10 year range, and I'm all for it. But biofuels are not one of these technologies that require a major infrastructure change, large capital investments, or technological breakthroughs that are still to come. We're talking things that are purely a will to do it and economics. Now, there are naturally some open questions and there are some economic challenges. So I'm not an expert on this. What I wanted to do was set the tone talking about the importance of what we could do to the local economy and our own ability to control our economy, basically the state of Oregon. In other words, right now, if oil prices fluctuate, since we have no infrastructure and we have no producing capability, the only role we can play in the global petroleum industry is helpless victim. That's our role. That's what we get. On the other hand, if oil prices were to drop dramatically, there's questions of, well, how competitive will biodiesel be able to get? So it's not like we shouldn't look hard at the economics of the biodiesel industry and at what levels it can compete and how much volume has to be able to be introduced in Oregon to make it economical. The speakers on the panels will do a much better job talking to that than I could, but definitely it needs to be discussed. So in closing, the point that I hope I've set the stage for is a discussion of why Oregon is well positioned to use biodiesels to strengthen our economy and to lessen our dependence on forces that we cannot control. As I said, we have all the ingredients here. We simply need the ability to actually do something with them. We need the support of the local government. And we need the support of the entrepreneurs and the people who are actually buying gasoline and diesel now. It's important that it be viewed as an opportunity, not some global do-gooder thing. So if I got nothing across, I hope I got across that this is an opportunity for Oregon to take control of its economy and to create more jobs and create more independence right here. Thank you.
So I wanted to thank first Andrea Lewis, who is the creative director with Energy Element, who organized this event today. Let's thank Andrea.
There are individuals who have really, really made this whole project come together, and some of those individuals have been Kathy Pepper, Sandy Mary, Solar Richard, Grant Remington, Grant Brady, Jim Skinner, Jacobo Boyd, Lauren Fennell, Marlise Franklin, Chris Hagerbaumer, Chris and Pat Foundation, Peter Moulton of Climate Solutions, Bill Ister of the Biodiesel Club. I'd also like to thank our bands, too, the New Iberians, Tarka, Acrodesia, Orco, for which we're going to do a later oil tour from, Albino Bank, Postal Central, Northwest Auto Sports, Rising Phoenix Biofuels, Home Power Magazine, Alder Creek Kayaking, Green Energy Transportation Tour, Acme Stages and Stages Northwest, and I'd also like to thank Kyle Collins for inspiring me every day to do these kinds of projects. So we are now going to have Chris Hagerbaumer, and she's going to be introducing our next panel, and thank you very much for attending.
So how is the sound? Can people in the back of the room hear? Okay. So thank you again to our introductory speakers were Paul Needham with Buy Local and Mitchell Hartman, former editor of the Oregon Business Magazine. And those guys don't have to stay up here on the podium if they don't want to. What I'm going to do is introduce a very distinguished panel of presenters. It's basically the idea is Biofuels 101. Everything you wanted to know about biofuels. We have five speakers, and I'm going to introduce each one, have each one give about a 15-minute presentation, and we're going to take Q&A at the end of that. So if people can just jot down your questions as we go along, because actually the next speaker might answer the very question that you had. The idea is that all day, until about 4 o'clock, there will be speakers. You're welcome to go in and out as you please. Tell other people to come in. But this is the panel if you want to know more about biodiesel and ethanol and what it means to Oregon. Again, my name is Chris Hagerbaumer, and I'm a program director at the Oregon Environmental Council. We have been working to promote the use and production of biofuels in Oregon. Together with the Oregon Business Association, we performed a biofuels cluster analysis, developing a comprehensive list of the people in Oregon who are stakeholders in this issue, and we identified the needs of what's basically a fledgling industry in Oregon. During the 2005 legislative session, we led an effort to get biofuels legislation adopted that was unsuccessful in 2005, but we expect it to be successful in 2007. And we've also developed what's called the Oregon Biofuels Network, which is basically folks who are interested in moving policy along in the state. If you're interested in that, you can visit www.biofuelsfororegon.org. That's the numeral four, biofuelsfororegon.org. We're also doing some marketing of biodiesel as well. So here you're going to learn about how biofuels help local economies and communities while lowering our impact on the environment. And our first speaker, well, let me tell you the five speakers we have. Brian Jamieson is with Go Biodiesel Cooperative. He'll describe what biodiesel is, what its environmental attributes are, and how to get and use it. Mark Fitz with Star Oil Co. will describe the home uses of biodiesel, for example, as home heating oil. Thomas Endicott of Sequential Biofuels will discuss the emerging biofuels industry in Oregon. Don Wysocki with the Oregon State University's Extension Services will describe agricultural communities' interest in biofuels and discuss what crops can be grown to produce biodiesel. And Chuck Carlson with Cascade Grain will describe what ethanol is, what its environmental attributes are, how it's used today, and how it might be used and produced tomorrow. Again, I'm going to introduce each person individually, and we're going to have PowerPoint presentations. Let's start with Brian Jamieson. Brian Jamieson is the co-founder and president of the board of Portland's Go Biodiesel Cooperative. There's a booth outside. And the web address of Go Biodiesel Cooperative is www.gobiodiesel.org. Brian is an accomplished startup entrepreneur and advocate of sustainable capitalism. Brian started his first business at the age of 14. Today, he operates a commercial biodiesel pump in southeast Portland, owns and manages Bluebird 58, an award-winning sustainable living ecoplex, and also manages the sustainable computer consultancy Open Sorcery, and is also involved in Portland's newsforneighbors.net. In his spare time, he's working on his third book, Power from the People, How to Start Your Own Biodiesel Cooperative. Welcome, Brian Jameson.
Thanks. Hello, everybody. How you doing? I'm Brian Jameson. I am part of the Go Biodiesel Cooperative. We're based out of Portland. And I just want to say this is a fabulous podium, if you haven't noticed. Thank you for bringing that. I'm here today because I'm a petroleum addict. And a few years ago, I decided to try and kick my addiction. And I've been fairly successful with that. Primarily, I use biodiesel. And I'm going to go through a little bit of biodiesel 101. Go ahead and hit the next slide. So what is biodiesel? Biodiesel is really an amazing fuel. I started using it about 4 years ago. And when I first used it, I got into this huge research kick, and I thought, there's got to be something wrong with it. What could be wrong with this fuel? It sounds too good. So I spent about 10 hours looking for what was wrong with it. Couldn't find anything. Put another 10 hours into it. Couldn't find anything wrong with it. Another 10 hours. Still couldn't find anything wrong with it. I'm a skeptic. You should be getting this at this point. The bottom line is I spent about 2 weeks researching, talking to people, trying to find out what was holding people back from using biodiesel. Because every time I looked, I couldn't find anything wrong. So basically the problems that we have today with biodiesel are so small. They're basically people like you need to adopt it. That's the problem. A few other things need to come up, like we need to have increased production. But I'm going to show you today that it's a really incredible fuel, and there's really no issues with it whatsoever. So here's the 21-word description of biodiesel. I think everyone's had time to read that. Want to hit the next slide? Okay. One thing you need to know about, there's a lot of terminology that's thrown around a little bit with biodiesel, and the primary one is about blends. So you need to understand when you go to the pump and you're looking at biodiesel, you're researching it, very frequently it's described as B with a number. The number after it is the percentage of biodiesel that you're getting. The other percentage would be how much petroleum is in it. So B2 is only 2% biodiesel. B20, which is a very frequent blend, 20% biodiesel, and so on. So today, whenever I'm talking about biodiesel, I'm meaning 100% biodiesel. Okay? All right. For me, the number one thing about biodiesel and the most important thing for us is that the emissions do not kill us in the short or the long term. I think that's kind of a big deal. If anyone's ever been behind a big diesel truck, anyone? Yes, okay. You get that really awful, black, noxious, terrible spume coming out of the back. And it's really frightening because it contains all sorts of little particulates that get caught in our lungs and kill us. I don't like that, and I find that biodiesel actually has 94% less of those. If you look at a biodiesel vehicle that's running 100% biodiesel, you don't see any emissions coming out of it whatsoever. That's when you're stomping it on the floor. I mean, nothing comes out in terms of anything visible. And that reflects the fact that there's only a very, very, very small percentage of nasty things in there. It's so safe to breathe that when the EPA did a test on it, they weren't able to eradicate the poor little animals that they were trying to do so with the exhaust. It's really that safe. It's a terrible thing. It has the lowest greenhouse gases of any fuel that we can currently buy. Now, obviously, hydrogen is a completely different issue, and as was pointed out by Paul Needham, you can't use it today even if you wanted to. So we're not going to go into that. We're talking about fuels that you can get today. That's not me talking. That's a study that was done in part with Harvard University and Ford Motor Company, and I think they know what they're talking about when it comes to greenhouse emissions. The worst offender is natural gas, and it goes all the way down the list to 100% biodiesel. And there's several reasons for that. One of the reasons is the carbon cycle, which I'll get into a little bit later. Another important point about it is biodiesel doesn't have sulfur, which you do have when you burn traditional diesel. Sulfur is a really nasty thing. Not only does it smell bad, it's actually very bad for us to breathe. The thing I like about it, of course, is it smells like popcorn or French fries or donuts. It doesn't really smell like fish. If you use fish oil to make it, I actually had a chance to smell some biodiesel that was made from fish oil, and it wasn't bad at all. Okay, so what I was going to talk about before was the greenhouse emissions. And this is sort of a thing that comes out frequently by people. What are their thoughts about this on the CO2 that comes out, which is the main greenhouse gas? Can we hit the next slide? Okay. When you burn biodiesel, you actually do emit a greenhouse gas, CO2. All right, so that does go out into the atmosphere. However, and this is the key point, the CO2 that's emitted from your tailpipe is balanced by the CO2 that was taken in by the plant that was used to create the biodiesel while it was alive. So there's a cycle. Instead of extracting fuel from the ground that's been sitting there for 20 million years, that's been very nicely sat there, we pull this out, we spew it into the atmosphere, it causes problems. Now we have biodiesel, which gives us a nice, sustainable, perfect circle. Okay? Yes. This little last point might be addressed later. I think it's an important point to get across, and people frequently ask about biodiesel and, you know, can we fuel, you know, can we displace all of our petroleum use in the United States with biodiesel today? No, we can't do it because we waste way too much petroleum. But if we were to reduce our petroleum use to a reasonable level and use algae and other technologies to use biodiesel, we could displace all of our petroleum use. So research that. The algae is a really great thing. Okay. The only negative thing that comes out of burning biodiesel is something called NOx. It's frequently confused with laughing gas, but there's nothing really funny about NOx. You get NOx when you burn anything in our atmosphere. Okay? Doesn't matter what you burn, you get NOx out of it. NOx is a precursor to smog. It's one of the components to smog. Okay? It's not really a greenhouse gas. And in fact, there is some ongoing research that may show that NOx actually pulls methane out of the atmosphere, which would make it something that would reduce greenhouse gases. Now, that research is not totally complete, but at least there are some possible positive benefits. However, regardless of the NOx, there is some technologies. There are at least two technologies that are expected to be rolled out in the 2006 or 2007 timeframe that will reduce these NOx emissions down to something very, very small. So this is not something where we're waiting for this breakthrough to make it happen. The technology is out there. They're just trying to work out a few details. The key point to take away from this NOx issue is that it is a very small point on the whole spectrum of biodiesel, okay? The big things about biodiesel that you need to keep in mind are it is really, really safe in terms of emissions, and it's not going to kill us from the things that come out of it. And, of course, we've got the carbon cycle. So, okay. It is actually safe to eat, but it does make a poor salad dressing. There's a story about this. There was a guy who did a world around-the-world trip on a sailboat, and sailboats are very environmentally friendly, and he wanted to have an environmentally friendly fuel along for the times that there's no wind and you need to get somewhere. So having a diesel engine, he chose biodiesel. So he was shipping these 55-gallon drums of biodiesel place to place. Well, he shows up somewhere, it was like Malaysia or something, and he couldn't find his 55-gallon drum of biodiesel. Where is it? So he looked and he looked and he looked, and they tracked it down finally to a cafe where they had been mistakenly using it as salad dressing. For real. It is that safe. You really can't eat it. It's 10 times less toxic than table salt, which, you know, we all know how much salt we eat. It biodegrades faster than sugar, and you can eat it. And there's a guy who runs around, you know, taking tablespoons of it. I do not advise this because it is It does wonderful things to your digestive system. It's a great laxative. So there are better things on the market, though. So if you're looking for that, I wouldn't do that. Okay. Just a quick comparison between the co-products. In other words, what do you get when you make gasoline versus what do you get when you make biodiesel, right? Well, gasoline, we all know, it's completely non-renewable, right? You have to transport it huge distances, at least 500, maybe 10,000 or more miles. The technology is expensive. It causes all sorts of problems. It requires gigantic infrastructures, immense investments in money. And cleanups, and the co-products are Superfund sites, greenhouse effect, war, all sorts of fun stuff like that. So you contrast that with biodiesel, which is just completely on the total opposite spectrum in terms of what you get, right? It's 100% renewable, 100% renewable. Every component of it is renewable, okay? The transportation can be as simple as right on the farm where the fuel is being grown. In fact, if a farmer wanted to grow fuel to use that fuel to power their entire operations, they'd only need to dedicate about 10% of their land to do that. It's a very efficient fuel. So transportation is very, very simple, very, very quick. The technology is incredibly simple to build. The cooperative has built a processor, and believe me, if the cooperative can build a processor, anybody can build a processor. Okay, we're not really highly technical people. Making biodiesel, in fact, is simpler than brewing beer. They're very safe, and they're incredibly small. The co-op's processor, which does about 100 gallons per batch, takes about 10 square feet entirely. It's a very, very small amount of technology that's necessary. And, of course, the co-products, for real, when you make biodiesel, the co-products are soap and water. I'm serious. That's what you get when you make biodiesel. You get biodiesel, soap, and water. In fact, some people don't even use water. And you also get happy farmers, happy local farmers, and as Paul pointed out, local money in the economy, which I think is a pretty big win. Okay, here's the big question that I have for everyone out here, and I want to get a sense. Who thinks biodiesel costs the same or less than gasoline right now? Okay, looks like about 10 people. How many people think it costs more than gasoline per mile? Much more people, about three times more. How many people have no idea? Okay. All right, so I'm not counting 100 people. All right, whatever. All right. The fact of the matter is, you've probably seen this recently. Move on. Biodiesel costs about the same today. And I have a little spreadsheet here that I update on a regular basis, and I'm comparing two vehicles about as apple to apple as you can get here. These are 2005 models of the VW Beetle, the Turbo S, which gets about 23 miles to the gallon, versus the TDI, which gets 31 miles to the gallon in the city. Current costs of gasoline, I'm assuming, are $2.55. Sounds about right, $2.55. Biodiesel, well, at least I get biodiesel for $3.11, something like that. If you look here on the bottom, the costs are 0.0006. And that's, you know, if the one was over there, that would be a dollar. So it's a fraction of a penny per mile more to use biodiesel in this city. A fraction of a cent. A fraction of a fraction. The highway costs are actually cheaper. It's actually a penny cheaper to run biodiesel today on comparable vehicles. Now, I wonder how many people think the price of gasoline is going to go substantially down. Nobody? Okay. Chances are real good that biodiesel is going to stay about the same, and in fact, it might even get cheaper. Like, we hope it's going to get substantially cheaper because more and more people are going to use it, and good people in the Oregon state who are already working on biodiesel and producing biodiesel here are going to sell so much of it, they'll have no choice but to sell it for less. So, that is that. Okay. Now, how hard is it to convert to biodiesel? How hard is it to convert your vehicle to biodiesel? Anyone think it's pretty difficult? How many people think it's hard to convert your vehicle to biodiesel? Oh, the message is getting out. I'm so happy. Okay. Yeah, the question was meaning a diesel or a gasoline car. Yeah. Well, actually, there is a three-step conversion process. And I'll answer your question with that right here. The three-step process is, number one, buy a diesel. If you've already got a diesel, you don't have to do that. Number two, unscrew the fuel cap. Number three, pour in the fuel. You're done. Okay. Moving on. I want to talk a little bit about what you have to do if you have an older vehicle, and then I probably have to roll. So when I'm talking about old, I'm going to say older than 1992. Some people will say older than 1996. That's fine. Say 10 years old or so on your vehicle. There's a couple things that you need to do. If you have any natural rubber fuel line in your fuel hose that has to be replaced, usually it's about that much, which costs about $10 and takes about 10 or 15 minutes with a screwdriver, and that's for a monkey like me to do. I mean, it's a really, really simple operation. So that's with a 10-year-old or more vehicle. That's what you have to do. There's a phone number to find Viton, the proper type of hose, but there's plenty of places you can get that. There's another thing that you have to do if you're going to convert your vehicle, and that's if you have an older vehicle that's been running on the terrible fuel that we have, the dirty, dirty, nasty petroleum fuel that we have here in the United States, you have to change your fuel filter after you convert and you move to anything more than a 20% blend of biodiesel. You have to do that after about 20 hours of engine use. There's no hard and fast rule. And that's because biodiesel will go in and completely clean out your engine system, totally clean it up for you, and the deposits will end up in your fuel filter. So you might need to change your fuel filter if you do that. On a newer vehicle, obviously that's not an issue because you already have a clean fuel system. Okay. The last real issue to consider when you're using biodiesel is how it handles freezing temperatures. Biodiesel begins to gel and turn into a solid around 32 degrees. It doesn't turn completely solid at that point. It really requires a lesser temperature to do that. So a couple of things. If your fuel tank does happen to freeze, there's no harm to the fuel. The fuel that's brought over from the Midwest gets frozen already anyway. It's not an issue. Personally, I haven't had any real problems. The last really wicked winter I had, both of our cars' tanks froze, and we just waited until they thawed out, and everything was fine. There are four solutions, though, to dealing with this weather, so this weather problem. If you're going to, say, Mount Hood or something like that, you're going to want to go to the harder level of things, but if you're just going to stay around here, I mean, how many days per year does it get below freezing here? You know, a couple days a year, it's really not a big deal. So my solution is not to drive when it's freezing. I don't happen to like driving when there's ice on the road anyway. So that's not a big deal. The other thing you can do is just blend in 20 to 50% of traditional diesel. It's already got an anti-gel in it, and it'll take care of you. You can also add anti-gel straight into your tank. You can buy it over the counter at an auto parts store. And the last thing you can do is, if you're going up to Mount Hood all the time or you're really concerned about it, you can add a fuel line, inline fuel heater, and tank heaters. And those are fairly inexpensive to do. Okay, last thing, pitch for the co-op. We're out here. We have a little booth. There's about 90 members in the co-op. We make our own fuel. You're looking at maybe 2 to 4 hours of work in exchange for biodiesel that's produced locally on a team effort at $2.25 a gallon. We may actually be able to get that price down a little bit. It's pretty expensive, I know. And we also make really great fry bread from our biodiesel. If you've ever come to our Earth Day shows, we make fry bread out of biodiesel, and we take the oil and make biodiesel out of it. So, anyway, I think that's everything, and I'm going to turn it over now to Chris. Thank you.
Thanks, Brian. Next speaker in this panel is Mark Fitz. Mark Fitz has a bachelor's in economics from the University of Alaska in Anchorage, where he focused on petroleum economics. He has worked at Star Oil Co., his family's business, for the past 5 years as an operations manager. Prior to that, he worked as an environmental compliance manager in the military. Earlier in his military career, Mark was a laboratory specialist focusing on quality control for fuels in the lab, as well as an Army fire support specialist. Born and raised right here in North Portland, Mark is in his last year of law school at Lewis and Clark College. Mark launched the biofuels program at Star Oil Co. basically within a month of when he started there. He's very excited about biofuels, and he's going to tell us about the home uses of biodiesel. Welcome, Mark.
I had a presentation, but when migrating it over from Word to PowerPoint this morning, I lost it. So I greatly apologize. You'll have to visualize. I'm going to go through equipment and talk to you. And I also wanted to thank everybody here. For the last 5 years, I've been jousting a biofuels monster. And I'll tell you, it's people like you who actually show up and want to care who are actually going to afford this choice. Because government isn't going to do it for you. You guys actually have to become very aware of what these choices are and then communicate to what your leaders do in their own policies. All right, let's start with it. In this room, heat, it's a very intimate thing. It's what you heat your house with. It's what you actually inhale in your own environment. How many people here heat with electricity? It's the easiest way to outfit a house, so you see a lot of construction that goes up new. It goes up with electricity, but it's extremely expensive to heat with, and you're pulling hydropower, which is actually offsetting coal and natural gas power in other parts of the country. So you got that as your first source. It is the least efficient for BTUs that you'd heat with in your house. Next up, who here heats with actual kerosene? None. It's more popular in agricultural areas. It's also an oil product. Who here heats with natural gas or propane? Ah, very popular in Portland. But once you get outside the city and you get away from actual, you know, supplies, heating oil and, of course, wood and pellet become really popular. Anybody here with wood or pellet? All right. Those are also biomasses, but they're not quite as cool as biodiesel. Now, when you look at it and you look at how you'd actually heat, you've got the different types of fuel which have different BTU contents. BTUs are what you actually look at how dense of energy, what it takes to raise a gallon of water, you know, a degree in temperature. It's how much energy you get from that product. Heat oil has 138,000 BTUs. Those BTUs are the reason a diesel vehicle gets more fuel miles per gallon than a gasoline vehicle or a natural gas vehicle or a propane vehicle. Going down the line, you have biodiesel, which is just slightly less energy dense at 131,000 BTUs. The next up, running up to that, is natural gas. Natural gas has somewhere between 110 and 120 BTUs per therm, which means you get around 20 to 25% more energy in a gallon of biodiesel than you do in a therm of natural gas. And it's safe to move around. No one's house has ever exploded from biodiesel. You also can use it in multiple devices. Moving down the line there, you also have your other biomasses like shelled corn, which is blowing up the Midwest right now. They grow corn. They convert a simple pellet stove, a lot like we convert vehicles here, and they're able to use raw corn that's dried in a pellet stove, and you have your standard hardwoods and wood pellets. Comparing the other biomass products that you produce that are pretty common, the wood, the corn, and the pellets, you're looking at 8,000 BTUs per pound of those biomass products. 8,000 BTUs per pound, when you compare it to the same weight in biodiesel, is 54,000 BTUs. So you get, you know, a third, roughly, the same energy content from the same amount of weight from that biomass. So biodiesel is really kind of an amazing technology when you look at it from that perspective. You get an amount of energy that you really can't duplicate from any other source, and you get to use proven technology that's been around for over 100 years, as biodiesel is what the diesel engine that Rudolf Diesel pioneered was kind of based to run. It's amazing. No millions of dollars of subsidies required. All you have to do is educate yourself and move out there and begin to use a cleaner domestic product. Now, how do you heat with oil? It's kind of convenient. You heat with oil just like you heat with any other fuel. You have to vaporize it, though, to get it to catch on fire, which is a positive thing. It makes it completely safe. Standard heating oil is actually a non-toxic product, unless they put a bunch of bad stuff like sulfur and things like that in it, and benzene and God knows what. But, of course, we have laws now to kind of protect us from refiners from dumping that product into diesel. But diesel is a non-toxic, biodegradable product. Now, I'm not going to drink it. You know, it's definitely not that safe. But either way, you've got that product that you can move around, and it doesn't catch on fire, and it's extremely stable when treated correctly. Biodiesel, even more so. So you have this existing infrastructure that's been proven safe with codes that cities have written up already right out the box, ready to go, and boom, you're in business from alternative fuel. And BTU to BTU, it's going to be cheaper than natural gas, I guarantee, in the next 6 months. You know, when they readjust your natural gas rates, watch. You can convert to heating oil that runs biodiesel, either 100% blend or a 20% blend or some other blend you put together yourself, and it actually will save you money in that conversion paying for the equipment. Now, there are four main ways that you would heat with heating oil or any other heat source, and this is where the cool pictures would have came in. The coolest one, the one that's really tearing up the construction world for high-end construction these days, is what's called a hydronic floor heat system. You take a concrete floor like this. You lay out these, you know, pipes that have essentially water with some other stuff in the water to keep it from having issues in the floor, and you run it through a boiler and on-demand hot water heater system that basically heats that water, and it heats the floor. And in a room like this, where it would cost a lot of money to heat the whole room to get it all equal temperature blowing air around, it actually would heat the bottom 6 feet of it and save you a lot of money and energy. It also makes your house feel completely just even and clean the way the heat is. You know, you don't have a lot of blowing, a lot of dust, a lot of wear and tear on various other appliances as it tries to move it around because it just naturally convects up through the floor. That requires, which would be shown here, on-demand hot water heater or a boiler, which also can do your domestic hot water. It's cool stuff. I geek out on this stuff because it's kind of interesting because a lot of technologies have been coming out the last few years as we begin to adopt in the United States what Asia and Europe have known for a long time because, of course, their oil was never cheap. So, anyways, you got that hydronic floor heat. What's required for conversion? All you got to do if you have an existing heating oil system is change your mind, move directly to biodiesel. If you have other systems, you'd have to go and talk to an actual HVAC consultant, a contractor to come in and set it all up because that's pretty complex. New construction, sometimes it's offered right out the block. Moving down the line, you've got the oldest technology. It's kind of like a wood stove. It's called a pot burner. Pot burners were really popular after World War II. You go to Sears and Montgomery Ward's, and you'd buy them in oil or you'd buy them in wood. Basically, it's a wood stove. An oil one has an oil pot in it. It's extremely simple technology. The carburetor that drives it's over 100 and something years old, you know, probably even 200 years old. And essentially it puts a simple drip of fuel in the bottom of the pot, and it vaporizes it with the existing heat of the unit, and it heats your house just like a wood stove. They also have these in gas and propane, but more popular you see those basic models, your standard wood stove, your pellet stove. Heats with convection, not quite as efficient, but it's still there. And with oil, any oil appliance that's a pot burner across the board can likely run 100% biodiesel, homebrew even if you don't get all the glycerin out of it. It's something you can address right off the bat. Right off the bat, nothing wrong with it. All you got to do is set it up and start burning it. And what's great with these pot burners, too, is because they're so old, they're pretty bulletproof. Occasionally they wear through, but you'll find them on Craigslist. You'll find them in the Nicolats. Come get it, free tank, free pot burner, ready to roll. Next in line, you got your standard forced air system, which most of us are used to. Now, in Portland, something that's extremely common is you'll see what's called an octopus. It's a gigantic monstrosity, big pipes coming out of it. Well, when you see those, I mean, just ask, who in here has lived in a house or seen one of those gigantic furnaces? These are kind of cool. You go back to the 40s and the 50s. Coal and sawdust were the products of choice in Oregon. My grandmother's house, which my father still lives in, had a chute where the coal was dropped off, and they would literally have to shovel it over. Well, the 50s came along, and a few technicians figured something out, and this was the cat's meow. You would pay just a little bit of money, an oil heat technician would come in, they'd take the door off an old wood stove, you know, an old sawdust or a coal stove, and they'd put an oil gun burner on it, which is what sticks out. If anybody has an oil furnace or seen one, it sticks out near the bottom. Well, they just slap that bad boy right there on the bottom of it. The same heat exchanger for the coal and stuff would work for that. And because they were built so thick for wood and coal heat, they still exist today. And if they break, all you're talking about is swapping out that same gun burner, which is an extremely cheap part when you look compared to a full HVAC system. So those right there are around, and they will run a B20 blend, guaranteed, no problem. A modern efficient furnace, you know, any standard furnace that runs oil will run B20. You shouldn't have any issues whatsoever. B99, we have a few brave souls who've gone that route. No one from the National Heat Research Alliance, though, will cop to B99 being a good decision. I'll come back to that, talking about where concerns exist if someone wants to go that route. Then you have one other type of oil heat technology, and it's common for propane, natural gas, and oil heat with these, and it's a direct vent unit. They're extremely inexpensive. You install them against an outlying wall, and they have an exhaust vent that, you know, goes directly out the back wall. Those are really easy and simple to install, and they make them, you know, pour oil, and they can run B20 with no problems whatsoever. Now, moving down the line, what is involved with conversion? With converting to biodiesel, the first thing with B20, the only thing you really have to change is your minds, and you have to be aware of what's going to be coming down the pipe at you when you make this conversion. You'd call up one of the oil heat companies, Star Oil included, who happens to actually handle B20 heating oil on a regular basis. You'd set up a delivery day, or you'd even set yourself up for an automatic keep full where we take responsibility to fill your tank up, and we go ahead and top that tank off with B20. If it's empty, you're ready to go with B20. If it's not empty, you're going to have a blend below B20, but that's positive on your first go-around. And here's why. You have a tank. Now, as Brian was nice enough to point out, and I'm sure everyone on the panel will point out, the biggest concern when you go to biodiesel in a car is that you're going to have gums and varnishes in that tank that are going to wash down the stream and end up in the fuel filter. Imagine that issue times 200 to 500 gallons of tank. And some of these tanks are literally over, like, 75 years old. So you have some real buildup in there you have to be aware of with heating oil. So that's the first thing to be aware of. If you go with a smaller quantity of biodiesel blended in it, you're going to clean that up slowly and be able to get out ahead of it. With tanks, okay, because that's the biggest issue with conversion is being aware of your tank. You have two types of heating oil tanks installed. You have a below-ground tank, which is every real estate agent's worst fear, or you have an above-ground tank, which will either be stored alongside the house, in the basement, or someplace out of the way, out of the elements. If you have an above-ground tank, go ahead and go out and look at it. That's all you do. You look at it. No leaks, good to go. Just what you do with standard heating oil. If you have a below-ground tank, you have issues because you likely don't know how old it is. Now, there are oil tanks we've seen out there that we've pulled out of the ground. They're like 80, 90 years old, some of these tanks. Not a single problem with them the way they're installed. There are other ones that go in, and in 10 years, there are holes, and they're leaking, and they're polluting the ground, and it is not a good thing. A lot of times with these tanks, when they install them in the ground, corrosion begins to build up slowly. A few little rocks wear on it, a little bit of rust, a little bit of water on the bottom of the tank work in both directions. When heating oil comes in contact with soil, it makes gunk. That gunk usually seals these tanks. You know, it's not the way you want to fly, but it does happen. If you put biodiesel in that tank, if you went straight to B99, that gunk would be gone, and you now have a leaky tank out of the blue. So you want to be aware of that with the conversion. Moving downstream from the tank in the conversion, you got lines, just like with the car. You want to be aware of what those lines are made of. Now, by code, being what the city requires when these are installed, you don't want anything other than either steel or copper in line on these lines. But some people, doing it themselves, have decided to occasionally use rubber or God knows what in the line. I've never seen one, but I've been told every once in a while that exists. Be aware of that. And another benefit of starting with a lower quantity on your heating oil system, like a B20, is that if that begins to wear, it wears with a wet spot to start with. So you'd come into your basement, just walking through for laundry or whatever, and you'd look over and go, what's that wet spot? I should call my HVAC technician. If you went to B99, you'd come in and go, oh, my God, what's this puddle? You know, and it's usually big. So it's smart to be aware of that. But you got the lines. You're going down the lines there, and you want to use either copper or steel. Steel is preferred, but copper lines, which is pretty industry standard, are what you're going to see. From there, in line, you're going to have a fuel filter someplace in line. Oil industry standard uses what's called a general filter. It's our industry standard. It's proprietary. It's so guys like me can gouge it for $5 over what it really costs to buy the filter only from me. With biodiesel customers and all our customers in general, we've gone to recommending what's called a goldenrod filter, which is very common. In fact, it's your common agricultural filter in an agricultural tank to fuel a tractor with. It's visual. You can see the transparent filter through it. The filter can be picked up at any Napa, any CarQuest. So you walk past it every so often as you do around your house anyways, and you'll spot if you have serious gunk flowing through your system being caught by that filter. So if it needs to be changed, you'll know it needs to be changed, and you run to any hardware store or parts store, and for $3 or $4 get a swap out for that and take care of it real easy, and you're able to stay apprised of it. So that is recommended but not required for conversion. When you have an actual tune-up, they'll always swap out that filter. You should be good to go in most scenarios. But it's handy to go that little extra mile just so you know that everything's taken care of. Downstream from that, you now have a fuel pump. And with most modern oil systems, some pull fuel and drip it to the gun burner I talked about, which should be on the screen in a big pretty picture, have one line. But most of the modern ones have two lines. They're continually pulling product and moving it back to the furnace or back to the tank. So you're moving this product through your system. Be aware of that because the fuel pump, that's the amount of wear it's going to have if it's constantly moving or not. The one place we would ever expect to see an issue with biodiesel causing wear on any type of heating oil system is in that pump. Those pumps wear out just like all parts and cars and everything else in the world wears out. So just watch for it. Be aware. You know, you have two things with these systems that are extremely simple. You either have fuel or you have fire issues. Either it's out of fuel or it's not lighting. You know, so chances are if you have a problem with it, I've got a full tank, I'm not getting heat, my pump is broken, or I've got some type of igniter issue. So you'd be able to address that. But I'm getting out of there. So that fuel pump is the next in line. Then you go to your actual gun burner. Simple device. Takes fuel, sprays it through a nozzle. That nozzle vaporizes the fuel, and then it's able to catch on fire because heating oil or biodiesel, and by the way, heating oil in the Oregon and Washington market is diesel. It's just got a different ASTM spec to meet spec, but it's diesel. It's vaporized and caught on fire just like biodiesel, and that nozzle is the next part to be aware of. That nozzle could be worn out by biodiesel. My guess is, though, because biodiesel is a superior product to actual standard diesel, it's more lubricous, that it's not going to see the same wear you'd see with diesel, but even still be aware that that's something that needs to be annually checked up. And then vaporizes, catches on fire, you have a heat exchanger, you have an exhaust tube, and, of course, then you have an air handler that moves heat up through your floor or into your room. So air handler is never going to come in contact with the biodiesel problem. The heat exchanger will. But where do heat exchangers normally wear out? They wear out because you're burning a dirty diesel fuel that creates carbon and exhaust that cake up inside of that, and carbon gets bright red hot. You ever see the motor oil commercials where they're showing these vehicles go off and they have those bright glowing red? That's carbon. Biodiesel produces way less carbon. So therefore, that part will probably see a way longer lifespan converting to biodiesel. So that's one benefit, and it will clean out that entire system through to that point, and you'll have a cleaner exhaust from a renewable product. So that right there covered conversion and, of course, long-term use. Tanks. I talked about tanks before. If you have a heating oil system, swapping out the tank is part of your routine service of that unit. With going back to like natural gas, the average lifespan of a natural gas furnace or propane is anywhere from 10 to 15 years, depending on how fancy unit you get because of the thickness of the gauge of the steel that gas comes with. So every 10 to 15 years, you're likely to have to swap out that furnace at the tune of $25,000 to $3,000, depending on where you're getting. You get them sometimes as cheap as $1,000, but I don't have to do that anymore. Heating oil. The average lifespan of a heating oil furnace is 20 to 30 years. Kind of a better deal on that because you have to build with thicker parts. And, of course, biodiesel would probably prolong the life of the actual heat exchanger, the main unit that requires the turnover of a furnace. So when you look at it from that perspective, swapping out the tank to an above-ground tank that you'd never, ever have to change again if you maintain it because, of course, you can put a coat of paint on it, which prevents it from rusting. It's kind of a good deal when you kind of look at it in the bigger scheme of things if you're considering natural gas or oil, and biodiesel really appeals to you. So tanks are not a bad deal, and you have several options to go with from an underground fiberglass tank, which will never corrode, and all you have to worry about is an earthquake catching your yard just right, or going with an above-ground tank that you're able to traverse. Right. A big issue with conversion or with maintaining any furnace is making sure you get an annual tune-up. With a biodiesel furnace, am I doing okay on time? Right. With a biodiesel furnace, you're looking at the same thing you would with an oil furnace. three main parts you want to be concerned with. First off, the filter I talked about. That gets changed out with a tune-up every year, and it should, and you want to check with the guy to make sure he's checking it out. It's extra critical with the first year of your own biodiesel, though, because stuff's going to wash downstream. If you don't move to a goldenrod filter, you might ask your furnace guy who comes to check your furnace, hey, I want an extra filter, and show me how to change it, because it's really easy. You pull one out, you put one in. So after a month or two, you can even do that yourself, and it'll cost you probably $5 to $10 for that filter. Then the next in line is the nozzle. They swap out nozzles annually because they're a part that costs next to nothing, and to do the actual main service, which is to pull a combustion test to make sure your furnace is running efficiently, they look at that anyway, so they just swap it out. So those should never wear out if you get an annual service. So you got two of the issues with conversion taken care of right off the bat just by doing your routine maintenance on the furnace. And then, of course, the third is to make sure it's running efficiently and tune up the air-to-fuel mixture. Kind of handy if you already have biodiesel on the ground that you got a guy coming in here with a cool toy telling him exactly what it's burning at so he can turn it up or down depending on what the biodiesel blend is actually doing if it changes. So that's a positive. You can't exactly do that with cars that pull in and have a computer brain telling them where that fuel air mixture needs to be. So that's handy. And you arrange for a tune-up with your furnace by just calling your local heating oil distributor, whoever you're currently using. Several HVAC people do it too. I know that our HVAC technician that we use, he's got a lot of experience with biodiesel because he's done probably, I think, two or three dozen tune-ups for biodiesel customers who've got, you know, at least a few tanks underneath them. All right, and the last and biggest issue, cold weather awareness. If you have a below-ground tank or a tank that's inside, no big deal. If you have a tank that's above ground on the side of your house off by itself, there's a chance it's going to gel. And if it's going to gel, it's going to gel on New Year's Day or Christmas Day, and you're going to call me at home, and I'm going to come out, and I'm going to help you with it. But I'm not going to be happy. All right? Be aware. If you blend biodiesel and diesel together, just like with road diesel, you can put an anti-gel in it, and I usually recommend, and of course your parts store guy may or may not know this, but a jet fuel style de-icer which addresses the ingrained water in the fuel. What this means is the petroleum diesel has water in it, molecular level. The jet fuel style de-icer prevents that stuff from coalescing and becoming big ice crystals that then cause, you know, your diesel to become like margarine. You know, it gels up. You want to be prepared for that. Biodiesel by itself, straight biodiesel, cannot be treated as of yet. There are a few people out there making promises, but we haven't been able to test that enough to stand by it and say, this solves all your issues, go ahead and have a Christmas party. So be aware that biodiesel by itself can't be treated. It has to be blended with actual petroleum diesel. So if you want to go to a B99 or you want to run some type of appliance with a B99 blend in it, and why I say B99, not B100, I'm sure Tom's covered this, we only sell B99 because there's a government subsidy we pass directly on to you to put 1% petroleum blend in it. So in running a B99, you're not able to address that to treat it below freezing. So you're going to need to keep that tank out of the elements, in a basement, off to a side, or maybe, this is just going out on a limb, potentially, wrap that bad boy all in that heat tape like you put over your plumbing. That may or may not help. We don't know. So, and there are also special order nozzles you can pull for a tank that float and pull product off the top. So if it did gel, the glycerin would fall, the margarine looking stuff would fall to the bottom, and it would just suck clean, you know, the ungelled fuel down the line. So you have that there as two solutions if you want to go with B99. And I'll say just one more thing too, one benefit of biodiesel heating oil. You get a 275 or 500 gallon tank that is not regulated inside the city of Portland. Now, they have a few code issues that they require you to jump through, but if you're in Washington or in Clackamas County, you're smooth sailing. All you got to do is make sure you're not a moron when you set it up. I mean, no offense. But, so you just got to set that up. If you request from your biodiesel delivery company, Star Oil and Albina Fuel does it, Sequential does in certain regions of the state, and I don't know if Brian's going to be delivering or if he currently does, but if you call them and you ask for your biodiesel with road tax, meaning your Oregon state and your federal tax, we can deliver it in the heating oil tank, and you can set up that heating oil tank to fuel your on-road biodiesel vehicle. So that's one handy thing, too, because then you'll be buying in volume and saving over your street price and having the hassles of going to the very few locations that we've got up right now using it. You'd be able to hit that as a twofer. So that's one benefit of biodiesel heating oil. So in conclusion, it's a proven technology. Diesel's been around a long time. All the issues with it we know about up front. That's a real benefit when you're actually approaching on what you're going to invest your $25,000 into in a vehicle or your, you know, $5,000 to $10,000 in a heating system. It's domestically produced. It's cleaner burning. And it helps farmers and small business in this region because the people who deliver your heating oil to you, you got several dozen people in the city who deliver heating oil. I know you've got at least two, if not four, biodiesel heating oil delivery companies that are here, so you have that choice, and we're all small businesses. And I'll be out at the Sequential booth after this event, and thank you very much for caring about this issue.
So our first two speakers, Brian and Mark, basically gave you the nitty-gritty of if you want to use biodiesel, how would you use it? Our next two panelists will delve into the side about how would we produce it in Oregon, both from the perspective of using waste grease or using agricultural products. Then our final speaker, we're going to switch gears and talk about ethanol, which is a product that can be used as a substitute for gasoline. So I'd like to welcome Thomas Endicott, who's a founding member and managing partner of Sequential Biofuels, a biofuels marketing and distribution company with offices in Portland and Eugene. He's also a manager of Sequential Pacific Biodiesel, which is Oregon's first commercial biodiesel production facility. Thomas is one of the leading experts on the biodiesel market in Oregon. He began working in this arena around 5 years ago when he co-founded Eugene Biosource, a Northwest-based biofuels information and advocacy group. Thomas holds a bachelor's degree from Cornell University in biology and society with an emphasis on agriculture, environment, and community. He also holds a master's degree from the University of Oregon in community and regional planning. Welcome, Thomas.
Thank you, and I also want to thank Andrew Lewis and everyone else who put this together. Myself and my business partners have been in biodiesel now for 5 years, and we've waited a long time to see a gathering like this. We've seen a lot of momentum over the last year or so, and it's exciting to see people come out and be interested in biofuels. And also want to thank Mark and Brian that I don't have to give the technical lecture on what is biodiesel and all the ins and outs. I think they've covered that really well. And my job here today is to talk more about how we make this an industry, where biodiesel started and where we can take it. We are, Sequential is a marketing and distribution company in Oregon. If you drive biodiesel and you buy the fuel at a pump or you buy it from a distributor in Oregon, you're likely buying our fuel. And some of that is fuel that we produce here in Oregon. Some of that is fuel that we import from other producers in the Midwest. Go ahead. Simply, I think the people before me here, Brian and Mark, have clearly shown you that biodiesel is very simple. It's seamless with any diesel technology, your heating oil furnace, your car, your truck, your boat. And now it is a choice that's available in Oregon, and I want to talk a little bit about how that's happened. Next slide. And the bottom line here, I think, is why people were interested in biodiesel, why we got into biodiesel, why businesses and governments and individuals are driving biodiesel, and again, Brian really covered this. It's about the impact of the fuel, biodiesel versus petroleum diesel, the social impact, the economic impact, the circulation of dollars in the regional economy. We are a local company. We're here in Portland. We're here in Oregon. We have our legal services and our CPA services and our advertising. We spend money here in the state, and we're very focused on the region. Of course, the environmental benefits that Brian covered, the emissions reductions, the extending petroleum, great mileage for diesel vehicles. But probably the coolest thing, and thinking back 5 years, you know, is biodiesel is really cool because all of the impact that it has, you feel personally. And I remember the first trip that I took with my business partner 5 years ago in some biodiesel that we brewed up in our garage, and we really couldn't believe that it was true. And it's amazing. It's an incredibly empowering feeling. And I feel it all the time when I see more and more of these and Go Biodiesel stickers and other companies in the region with vehicles more and more driving around on biodiesel. Go ahead. So the next question really is how do we make this into an industry? It's been very fledgling, very small scale, but growing pretty consistently. And it really revolves around three things. awareness about biodiesel, which we're certainly working on that today, greater availability so people can get it easily and get it in their tanks, get it in their heating oil furnaces. And a lot of that revolves around advocating for it. As Mitchell Hartman had mentioned, it does need help from the government. We have had a lot of great support at the state level. There are some good federal incentives, but it takes more. It always takes that pressure from the public, and advocacy accomplishes that. So first, starting at awareness. Let's go ahead to the next slide. Obviously, you all have probably heard about this before. Biodiesel has been increasing in popularity over the last couple years. Perhaps some of you found out about it the way that I found out about it 5 years ago with this book from Joshua Tickell, who really is kind of the guru of grassroots biodiesel, and wrote a book that talked about the reasons why and also how to make it yourself and how to go from it that route. Over the last 6 months, especially over the last year, biodiesel has been getting a lot of press with celebrities like Willie Nelson out there talking it up, The Oregonian, OPB, NPR, even President Bush visiting a biodiesel manufacturing facility in Virginia a few months ago. So it's come up in awareness significantly over the last few years. Or maybe you saw this edition of National Geographic a few months ago, The End of Cheap Oil. And if you can't read that in the back, it says, "Think gas is expensive now? Just wait. You've heard before, but this time it's for real. We're beginning the end of cheap oil." This may be a graph that some of you have seen or heard about. This is what they call Hubbert's Peak. And this is a graph showing the total supply of oil in the world from left to right and the speed at which we've been extracting it from the ground and using it. There are about 2 trillion barrels of oil on the planet, and different experts estimate where that top of that curve is. Some say we've passed it. Some say it's about 2007. But the point is that there's only a set amount. We've discovered most of it, and we'll continue to discover more, but less and less as time goes forward. This is a supply curve in simple economics, and this is what demand looks like. So why are gas prices so high today? Is it because we're running out of petroleum? No, we're not running out of petroleum yet. We will eventually, but not yet. It's because China and India and South America and other people in the world want the oil as badly as we do, and want it for their economies and for their lifestyles. And so with a higher demand, the supply is somewhat stable. The price has been increasing. And many experts would expect that this is going to continue to happen over time. I might also add that it's, you know, petroleum. We use petroleum for gas and diesel fuel. It's probably not the best use of it. We also use it for more important things like plastics, fertilizers, pharmaceuticals, many other products. And once we burn this stuff up, it's gone. So petroleum's a little bit like money in the bank when it's in the ground, and once we run out of that, all we have is what we're producing on the surface of the earth with biodiesel, ethanol, vegetable oil, carbohydrates, and fats. Go ahead, and there's 3 lines here. Just to give you an idea of the scale of this, diesel fuel in the U.S., about 57 billion gallons a year, about twice that with gasoline and O2. It's a little higher this year. 720 million gallons or so of diesel in Oregon. That's about 2 million gallons per day. 1.4 billion gallons of gasoline consumed in Oregon each year. That's about 4 million gallons per day. We use a tremendous amount of fuel. We export a lot of dollars for this, and this is something that we can actually at least put a little bit of produce a little bit of this here domestically, increasingly more and more. Chuck Carlson will talk about ethanol here in a few minutes, but interestingly, the ethanol industry is about 3.5 billion gallons per year in the gasoline market. This year, biodiesel may be about 50 million. So it's a drop in the bucket today, but it can increase. Ethanol's quite a few years ahead of the biodiesel market. So the awareness is there. The market is certainly big enough. So the question now is, why aren't we using more and more of it? We are using more and more of it, but the ramp up is rather slow, and it's largely due to availability. When we first started out, Sequential's 3 years old. When we started our company, we had to find a supply to start. And the 2 places that we could get fuel were Southern California and the Midwest. Most biodiesel in the U.S. is made from soybean oil, made by soy producers in the Midwest. And we have to bring that in on rail cars. We've done that for the last few years. We continue to do it until we were able to build some production in the state. So, but in order to make enough a reason to bring those rail cars, and we had to have a pretty big a pretty big demand, and we had to have a way to move it around in the region. The way biodiesel is moved is the way petroleum diesel is moved. This is Tyree Oil down in Eugene, one of our distributors. Star Oil Co. here in Portland is a distributor. We also have distributors in Bend, Salem, Medford, Corvallis, Hood River, and always expanding. So as the market has come up, we've been able to increase the efficiency and the scope of the supply, and then next, go from the large distribution down to the smaller distribution. So Sequential has about 15 different locations around Oregon, and those locations are both cardlock and retail pumps for vehicles and also distributors for larger fleets and heating oil operations. And this is a very short list today. These were really the early adopters, and I don't have to use this slide so much anymore, but biodiesel is becoming mainstream, especially with the public fleets. Portland, Eugene, and Corvallis all use B20. You may have heard Dan Saltzman last Friday talking on the radio about Portland's use of B20 in their fleet. Washington's a little bit further ahead of us with City of Seattle using ultra-low sulfur with 20% biodiesel. And the largest user in the region is King County, Washington. They consume 10 million gallons of diesel per year in their operations. And for about a year now, they've been ramping up to a 5% blend, which is about 500,000 gallons of biodiesel, pure biodiesel per year. These have been extremely important to create the market, get the large amounts of product here, and be able to spread it out. And, of course, just quickly, the big fleets have been the ones where it started, but small businesses, TerraClean, I believe they're here, they have been avid biodiesel users from the very beginning. They were one of our, I think they were our first customer in Portland, and they walk the walk. Their vans are biodiesel. Their cleaning equipment is powered by biodiesel. Small businesses really believing in this, and it's a great marketing tool for them as well. Larger companies, Neil Kelly, many of you probably know Neil Kelly, and they run all of their trucks on a blend of biodiesel now out of their facilities here in Portland. On the river, this is a riverboat that has been up here on the Columbia and actually running pure biodiesel in its twin diesel John Deere engines on board and its generator. And if you hit Hoodoo Ski Resort down east of Salem, they actually run all of their equipment on a low blend, 10% blend, up on the mountain. So cold weather operations, not an issue. Up in the snow, it's really a seamless thing, and these businesses are getting on board. And last, but probably most importantly, are all the individual drivers. And this is just one example, the Corvallis Biodiesel Cooperative down in Corvallis. Biodiesel got its roots in Oregon by individual drivers who demanded that they wanted the product. And this is true with the Go Biodiesel Co-op here in Portland, Corvallis Biodiesel Co-op, Bend Biodiesel Co-op. And then, of course, that demand sort of grew to allow for pumps across the state. It is so important. This is an amazing industry where individual people have picked up on their own and said, we're going to do this, and put pressure on businesses and governments to say, you should be doing this. It's the right thing to do. And I commend all the people in Oregon. Biodiesel is more available in the Northwest than anywhere else in the country, and it's really because individual people have made it that way. So then all of those different users, where we are today is now these basically 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. I think we're actually up to 15 locations now in Oregon. A map of Washington would look somewhat similar. Sequential's not there, but a number of different distributors in Seattle, Tacoma, Olympia, Bellingham. And so the word's out, the demand is there, and it's increasing. And that all led for Sequential to a great opportunity, which was a partnership with Pacific Biodiesel from Maui, Hawaii, one of a handful of biodiesel production companies in the U.S. that has built commercial biodiesel production facilities and has one now in a joint venture with Sequential in Salem. This is the July 8th edition of the Statesman Journal, and the day before, Governor Kulongoski came, turned the valves on the plant, and started it running. This plant, next slide, a little bit different picture. Not a very big plant in terms of size, but capable of 1 million gallons per year of production. That's about what our market for biodiesel is in Oregon right now, but it's growing very quickly. The product out of this plant now comes into Sequential's distribution both in Portland and Eugene.
And some of the biodiesel that we sell is now made in Oregon. So we sort of had that vision that it could be this way, and we've gotten it there. Our feedstock for our commercial production is predominantly used cooking oil. This is one truck you might see running around the region. We collect from Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. And this is a grease collection company that we work with, a big 5,000-gallon vacuum truck that services largely chain stores. Sherry's Restaurants and Fred Meyer's, all of them in the region have been the first ones to come over. Kettle Foods, of course, is a huge partner for us in getting the used cooking oil out of their plant and turning it into biodiesel in the region. The product comes into the plant like this, into the plant looking a lot like that. Used cooking oil into the plant, and even though it looks a little rough right there, it ends up looking like this. Biodiesel on the right and the glycerin byproduct on the left. So that's where it starts. 1 million gallons of production isn't much when we use a 2 million gallons of diesel in Oregon every day, so there's a lot of room for growth. There's certainly a limited amount of used cooking oil in the region, so the next thing would be to go to virgin oil production, and Don Wysocki is going to follow me here and talk about this in depth, but the only point I want to make is we have a tremendous, Oregon is a very rural state. We all live here in Portland, but outside of Portland is very rural. Tremendous amount of grass seed land in the valley that could potentially be oil seed production. This is a test plot of canola and Corvallis at OSU. Next slide. We have a lot of underutilized grain storage. We have a lot of infrastructure here that's already in place for this. And then, of course, on the east side, large wheat production, which could also be some canola production, other oilseed production. So a lot of opportunity for growth here. And then as the market grows, Sequential's taken the next step, which is to actually go to full-blown retail stations. And our demand has been large enough. Our support in the market is great enough. This is an artist rendering, but we will open the first biofuels retail station, Sequential branded, in Eugene. Should be online about March. We'll offer blends of biodiesel with diesel, 5, 20, and 99% biodiesel. And if no one beats us to the punch, we'll have the first 85% ethanol pump open to the public in the state at this station. Very accessible from I-5, very visible, right next to an Exxon and right across the street from a Shell. So this is what... And I thank everybody in this room that uses biodiesel or advocates for biodiesel, because this really is a demand and supply market. We never intended to be in the B100 market. We never intended to do what we've done. We didn't think that the market would respond this way, but it has. And this is a great opportunity, and it's a way that we can make things happen and change the world without government, although we need to push that too. But this is how it gets started. So this will happen in March. And just about through to the end here, of course, the last piece being advocacy is so important. Here's a couple slides from Biofuels Lobby Day in Salem this past March. We had, obviously, in conjunction with Oregon Environmental Council, pushed legislation very, very hard. We had 100 biofuels-powered vehicles, mostly biodiesel-powered vehicles, and about 200 people on the steps of the Capitol, in the Capitol, talking to legislators. It was such a great show of support for biofuels, and it really was a shame that the corporate lobbyists kind of sidetracked the whole thing this year. Everyone will be back even stronger in 07, and we will get this done. You heard Mitchell Hartman mention Minnesota with a 2% biodiesel law. They're doing something similar, trying to push for that in Washington. We tried to push for it here in Oregon. And ultimately, we can get the kind of political power at the base to make that happen. And I just want to also mention here, of course, Oregon Biofuels Network that Chris Hagerbarmer mentioned, biofuelsfororegon.org. It's a great place to rally around these issues. And then in the region, more focused on Washington, Harvesting Clean Energy, harvestcleanenergy.org. These are great organizations, and there's a lot of opportunity to stay connected, stay participating in this whole movement and this whole industry after this event, which I hope will become an annual event. A lot of people staying connected and rallying online. So that's what I've got. My contact info, Sequential Biofuels. We're proud to be a sponsor of this event. And, of course, you see our truck out here and you see our booth in the back. We do offer biodiesel in all different ways around the state. So if you're interested, give us a call or send us an email, and we'll get you taken care of. Thank you.
Thanks, Thomas. Just to let you know, we have two more speakers on this panel, then there will be time for Q&A. And the following panel is actually a town hall where some local elected representatives will be at that. So our next speaker today is Don Wysocki. Don will focus on the agricultural community's interest in biodiesel. So you can make biodiesel out of waste grease or out of oilseed crops. And we're going to learn about what oilseed crops could be grown in Oregon or Washington. Don Wysocki is an extension soil scientist with the Crop and Soil Science Department at Oregon State University's Columbia Basin Agricultural Research Center in Pendleton. Don conducts educational programs and applied research on soil, water, and crop management in dry land cropping systems of the semi-arid Pacific Northwest. Don has conducted research and development recommendations for canola, which is one of the most promising biodiesel feedstocks. Don's past experience includes working as a soil scientist with the USDA Soil Conservation Service in Pasco and serving as an assistant professor at Iowa State University. Don has a Bachelor's of Science in Soil Science from the University of Wisconsin Stevens Point, a Master's of Science in Soil Science from the Washington State University, and a PhD in Soil Morphology and Genesis from Iowa State University. And I should be congratulated for getting all those words out. Thank you. Come on up, Don.
That message is the tours are about to begin, so if you're headed on a tour, you may want to catch one. One of our earlier speakers asked the question about whether you thought Oregon had large reserves of oil, and I think one person raised their hand. Would that person come up and talk to me after? Because I've got some land that we can negotiate drilling rights on, so... Would you go ahead here? This is my contact information. What I'm going to do today is speak to you about vegetable oils. To understand, you know, the background behind biodiesel, it's really made out of vegetable oil. So the outline in my presentation is this. I'm going to talk about oilseed crops, a little bit about canola, and then crushing oilseeds. And when you crush an oilseed, you get two product streams, the oil and the other part of the seed, which is generally livestock feed. So that's what I'm going to cover. Go ahead. Just in general, oil seeds are crops that have a seed that's high in oil, or the oil has some specific high-quality use as a lubricant or some other end product use. But those are oil seeds in general. Go ahead. The oil seeds that we see majorly grown in the U.S. are these: soy, sunflower, canola, and I'll tell you a little bit about canola later, peanut, and flax. And if you look at these down this list in the middle column, that is the oil content in the seed. And if you look at the oil content on these, you know, generally in some of these it's running about 40%. If you look at soy, where is soy? It's about 20%. Well, I'll explain that. Don't go ahead. Could you back up? Okay. Over on the right-hand column is the market share that oil is in our market, in the edible oil market. So if you go to the grocery store, 40% of what you see on the shelf is soy. 20% is sunflower. 20% is canola. The other 20% are other oils, palm oil, olive oil, et cetera, et cetera. Now, why do we use an oil seed here, soy, that's very low in oil content? The reason is we don't raise soy for oil. We raise it for protein. Soy is a protein source, 48% protein. The byproduct is oil. Most of these other oil seeds we raise for oil, and the livestock part of it is the byproduct. Soy is the reverse. Okay? Go ahead now. Thank you. rapeseed and canola. The difference between rapeseed and canola. Rapeseed is a plant. Canola is rapeseed that has specific chemistry in the oil and in the meal. Go ahead. There's a unique definition or a specific definition for canola, and that's the oil has a chemistry that's low in uric acid, which is a fatty acid. I won't explain that, but unique chemistry in the oil, unique chemistry in the meal. It's low in compounds called glucosinolates. Yeah. Anybody here raise chickens? If you're tired of raising chickens, just feed them something high in glucosinolates. It'll kill your chickens and you won't have that problem, right? So you want meal that's low in glucosinolates. And, you know, rapeseed is this plant. If you're a plant breeder, you breed these materials and you get something that's low in uric acid, low in glucosinolates. Good to feed the livestock, good to feed the people. Canola oil was approved by FDA in the 1980s for consumption in the U.S., so it's a relatively new food oil. Go ahead. This is where I come in. Realistic canola yields in Oregon. And this is a little chart I made up. And basically what you see along the bottom here is related to wheat yields. Most of our growers understand wheat yields because that's one of our dominant crops. And what you see across here is if you have land that has 40, 50, 60, or 70 bushel yield, these are the kind of canola yields you can expect on land in eastern Oregon, somewhere around 1,600 to 2,500 pounds of seed per acre. Okay? Go ahead. In western Oregon, some of my colleagues listed at the bottom here, Dr. Tom Chastain and Daryl Aronson, they've been raising canola, and I think Thomas showed us a slide of that. But in Corvallis last year, they were raising somewhere around 4,000 pounds of seed per acre. This is, earlier on, 20 years ago, we had older varieties and less efficient operations. So canola was raised 20 years ago, but today's yields with newer varieties and new technology, this is what we're reaching last year, 2005, in Corvallis. And this is really the first year of trials they've had. I know they're going to get better at it because I've been doing this for 15 or 16 years, and I got better at after the first few years. So, oil yield. Canola is a seed that I showed you is around 40% oil. When you crush it mechanically, you get about 33% what comes out of the seed is oil. The rest has to be removed chemically, but if you crush it, you start out with 1,000 pounds of seed here, you get about 46 gallons of oil out of 1,000 pounds of seed. And as you go up here, a ton of seed or 4,000 pounds of seed, it's about 183 gallons. And if you're raising 4,000 pounds of canola, it's 183 gallons of oil per acre. So roughly equivalent, 1,000 pounds of canola seed replaces one barrel of oil. A barrel of oil is 42 gallons. Okay, go on. Well, why aren't we doing this? And it all comes down to a rough economic cut. And just to throw out some numbers here, in irrigated land and in Willamette Valley land, farmers want to see a gross income. I say gross, not profit, but gross income of about $400 an acre. That's kind of if you don't make that much, you're not going to do it to it, you know, because you're not going to make enough profit, and the bank will have something to say about it, right? In eastern Oregon, our land's not as productive, land's not as expensive. That gross cuts about $200 an acre. So no matter what crop you raise, whether it's canola or mustard or wheat or, you know, some other cannabis plant or something, that's right. You want to gross $400 or $200 an acre. Go ahead. So canola prices are set on the commodity exchange at Winnipeg. And right now, FOB Portland, it's about 10 cents, 9 cents a pound. And to reach that $200 gross, all right, this is an Eastern Oregon chart, but you could put $400 and double these yields. But at 8 cents a pound, a grower would have to grow 2,500 pounds to gross $200. At 10 cents a pound, you're at a ton. If canola prices were 15 cents a pound, you're way over on the right-hand side of this chart. 1,300 pounds per acre. Those are all the break-even parts. Where are we right now? Right around that 10 cents, right around $200 an acre. So we're right on the margin of that rough cut, $200 an acre. Go ahead. Oil crushing. Hey, we grow this seed, we crush it, what do we get? We get oil and meal. Right now, raw oil trades, and again, it's set on the commodity exchanges, Chicago Board of Trade, Winnipeg Commodity Exchange, wherever oil trades. But oil's trading, raw oil trades, about 30 cents a pound right now. That's fluctuated from about 22 cents to 37 cents over the last 10 years. But if we take oil at 30 cents, meal, the other part of this, two-thirds of what you get is meal. It trades about 8 cents, okay, $160 a ton. And seed is trading at 10 cents. You put it through this mechanical press, you get oil and meal. That ton of seed at 10 cents a pound is what? Worth $200. We crush it. The oil that comes out at 30 cents a pound, we get about 660 pounds. That's worth $200. The meal that comes out is worth about $106 a ton. So that value added through crushing adds about $100 a ton. Those are the raw economics. Keep going. Fuel economics. Okay, 1 gallon of fuel or of oil, vegetable oil, is about 7.2 pounds. If you're going to put this into biodiesel, the feedstock to make biodiesel is the oil and methanol or an alcohol. That's about 85% of the cost of making biodiesel is the feedstock cost, which are those two products. Making that assumption, go ahead. If oil's trading at 25 cents a pound and using that 7.2 conversion and the feedstocks, it's $2.10 if oil trades at 25 cents a pound. If oil's trading at 30 cents a pound right now, you get about $2.50 in feedstock cost. And as the price goes up, consequently, the price of the feedstock in that gallon of fuel goes up. Just common sense. All right, got a couple more slides. To understand the vegetable oil market, you have to understand what's going on right now. This is the food label change that's going to occur in January of 2006. What's going to change? We have the label over there on the left. That's the current label. We now label total fats and saturated fats on the food label. You all knew that, right? Every time your spouse sends you down to the grocery store, you all look at that, right? Because you're all worried about those fats in your diet. Well, there's a new item that goes on the food label. That's trans fats, that little red line there. And that is controlling, or not controlling, totally controlling the oil market, but it's having an influence on the vegetable oil market. Go ahead. So trans fats on the label. These are trans fats. They're food label. One of the options was to put trans fats on the label and put a little footnote that says trans fat consumption should be as low as possible. FDA didn't choose that option because the food industry didn't like it. But we want to consume as low a trans fats as possible. The trans fat here is on top. How do these get in our oil stream, our vegetable oil stream? Go ahead. Well, we really have three kinds of fats. Saturated fats, monounsaturates, and polyunsaturates. What do we do in the oil market to add stability and shelf life to oils? We try to saturate them by hydrogenation. So we take these polysaturates and monounsaturates, hydrogenate them, try to make that oil on the top. And in doing so, in that process, we create trans fats. So what's happening is we're trying to move away from hydrogenated oils to get rid of trans fats. And if you go read the label on all these fast foods, and now they're actually using this marketing ploy, you know, zero trans fats across the top of the bag of Cheetos, right? Like you can all feel good about eating Cheetos. something, but zero trans fats is a marketing thing. Well, what's happening is we're selecting for those monounsaturates. We don't want the saturated fats. We don't want these polyunsaturates because they add instability. So we're choosing oils in the food industry that are high in monounsaturates, low in saturates, low in polyunsaturates. And as a summary of this, right now, if oil prices and the way things are arranged, we can move into growing somewhere around 100,000 to 200,000 acres of this oilseed crop, canola. That would produce somewhere around 5 to 20 million gallons, which you heard earlier is about 2 to 4% of the U.S. or the Oregon diesel consumption. 1,000 pounds of seed equals one barrel of oil. And growers need that $200 or $400 an acre gross income as a rough economic cut. And I thank you and appreciate everybody listening. I think this is a good conference, and I congratulate the people that organize this. Thank you.
Thanks, Don. Our final panelist today is Chuck Carlson, who will talk about ethanol. Chuck is president of Cascade Grain Products, a company that will soon be producing 100 million gallons of ethanol annually out in Klatskanai, which is west of here along the Columbia River. Chuck has been with Cascade Grain for the last 3.5 years. Prior to that, Chuck worked with ConAgra Foods as the senior trading manager at KBC Trading and Processing Company in California. Before that, he was general manager of Mid-Columbia Producers Incorporated in Morrow, Oregon. That's a $50 million grain company on the Columbia River. Mr. Carlson also spent 7 years with the Atwood Larson Company, where he served as vice president of West Coast Marketing and general manager of Atwood Communication Commodities, a brokerage company. Chuck Carlson is a certified public accountant who received his BS in accounting from the University of North Dakota and an associate's degree in accounting and agricultural business finance from the University of Minnesota. Welcome, Chuck.
I'm very happy to be here today, and I'm trying to whip through this pretty fast. I hopefully try to make up some of the time that so you have question and answers. But let's go through which picture you see up here is a 40 million gallon ethanol plant back in the Midwest. Phase ethanol industry, there's over 90 plants producing 4.1 billion gallons of capacity this year. Another 1.1 billion gallons is under construction, and many more plants are being considered. 15 years ago, you would have said a standard ethanol plant is about 15 million gallons. 5 years ago, they went to 40 million gallons. Now some of the ones coming out of that are into production are now 100 million gallon plants. ADM just recently announced that they are going to build two 250 million gallons per year ethanol plants. So this industry continues, gets larger and larger in size. And the existing ethanol plants that are out there are also doubling in size as they're built so they can double from where they're originally constructed at. Go to the next slide. We'll just show you what comes out of right now about over 95% of ethanol is made from corn. Can we see the next slide? There you go. And what comes out of a bushel of corn, you get about 2.8 gallons of ethanol. You get about 18 pounds of distiller dry grains, and you get about 18 pounds of carbon dioxide. So basically the bushel splits into the three products, ethanol, DDG, and CO2. And if you go to the next slide, okay, this is what distiller dry grain is. This is one of the byproducts. This is currently used for animal feed. You're getting around 27 to 30% protein. Here's where you're seeing some of the changes now that are occurring in the ethanol industry. Some of the advances that they're looking at, where they're putting either front-end fractionalization systems on the front of these ethanol plants, so you take away the endosperm and the bran, so you make fiber and corn oil after you crush the germ, or you do an extraction process on the back end, and you take the oil out of the thin stillage, and you come up with biodiesel. So Not only do you make ethanol, but you make biodiesel. You can make biodiesel on these plants. What happens then is distiller dry grains becomes a higher protein product, somewhere around that 40% protein, more equivalent to soybean meal. Now, the question that hasn't been answered yet, that I think anyway, is that capital structure that you have to do to put either the front-end fractionalization on or back-end extraction on viable at this point in time. And it's people are saying it is, but we'll see. But so what is our current ethanol usage in the U.S.? And this is by market. I'm going to have to get over here. Right now, we on ethanol, we use it either as an extender or an octane enhancer. And right now, that's up to 10% volume. It's about 30% of our market. That's our standard 10% blends. And they'll use it to, like I said, just for extending the gas product. We see a lot of that going on right now, even with the hurricane taking away some of the existing gasoline refining capacity in the U.S. There was a quick demand for the ethanol to just for an extension of it. And oxygenate, of course, for clean air. In the RFG areas, for smog reduction, that's that 5.7 blend that they're using in the reformulated gas areas, and also in the oxy fuels like we do here in Oregon in our winter CO2 blending. Of course, we've met our attainment now, and that winter CO2 blending will go away in 2007. That's why we're pushing so hard in our legislative sessions for a 10% mandate for ethanol in this in our area, or we actually could see our ethanol blending go away in this area. Next slide. Currently, in the U.S., in the ethanol used by market, your mandated markets, in other words, your RFG, your carbon monoxide areas, are 71% of your market. Only about 29% is voluntary, where they're blending it for extension or octane. And so in the whole U.S., you know, last year we produced about 3.5 billion versus 139 billion gallon gasoline market. So we're just a very thin slice of this puzzle at this point in time, and hopefully we can get it larger than that. Next slide. Of course, here's the ethanol benefits from an environmental aspect, and you can basically just go down the list and see what it does decrease. Of course, carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, and your greenhouse gases are reduced by as much as 30%. So it's very environmentally friendly, and you know, that's one of the reasons we say is wanting to push it to more of a higher blend. Next slide. Now we get into ethanol uses, and a lot of you are used, of course, to E10 blends, which is your CO2 winter blend here in Oregon. We also have our E85 market, which is just a very infant in its infant stage here in the U.S. There's only about 400 stations throughout the whole country that are selling E85, even though there's about 4 million vehicles that are out there that are capable of running E85. Fuel cell applications down the road, what they're looking at, some ethanol is a very practical way to get hydrogen. University of Minnesota has done a lot of studies on that, and they're saying when we get to a hydrogen-type system, ethanol may be a very good component in that application. We also see ethanol-diesel blends. Not so much out here, but when you get into the Midwest, you see a lot of 10% ethanol going into diesel, and the reason you see it there is for its cold flow properties. Like we were talking before, when diesel or biodiesel gets cold, it tends to gel up. So back in the Midwest, you'll see a lot of people adding 10% ethanol to the diesel. Now, where you see it there, because it changes the classification because of its combustion rating, you'll see it only in the fleet usage because it changes from your standard diesel to a higher combustion level, so you don't see it being sold through the public pumps. So where you see it, like I know Winnipeg used to do running all their bus systems. You see it in Colorado, even in California, they have approved it because of, it reduces the emissions considerably. The flip side is also, when we'll get to that slide, you also are starting to see some of the studies being done in adding a little biodiesel to an E10 blend to increase the mileage. We'll touch on that in a few seconds here. But of course, you have your non-fuel markets. Of course, everybody knows the beverage side of the business. We're just one big still. And then, of course, we have the industrial solvent chemical feedstocks. Now we get into some of the advances. I wanted to show things that are going on primarily outside of the U.S. and what is happening. Saab came out with a vehicle here just recently. It's called the Saab 9.5 Biopower, and they've released it in Sweden. They're starting to do some demonstrations in Europe with it. And it's an E85 capable vehicle. What makes this one unique up against other E85 vehicles, it's got a variable pressure turbocharger on it. And if you flip to the next side, Popular Science did this article on it this summer, and we do some in June. They go through all the fancy explanation, but the one I liked on the bottom is that with that variable pressure turbocharger, there's no reduction in mileage with using E85 over gasoline. That has been the biggest critics. They say you usually get about a 30% decrease when running a straight E85 in a vehicle because of the lower BTU, but with that variable speed turbocharger in that vehicle, they saw no reduction in the mileage. So they're making some very big advances in that type of technology. Again, it's right now it's available only in Sweden, some demonstrations in Europe, and I don't know when or if we'll see it in the U.S. But next slide, it comes in variable, and that's the wagon version of it. And so, showing some slides in here, a lot of people have always said, well, you lose 3 to 5% in your mileage when you go to an E10 blend. American Coalition of Ethanol put together this study using 2005 vehicles that were non-E85 compatible. They're running them on just straight unleaded, 10% ethanol blend, 20% blend, and a 30% blend. Plus one of the main reasons I wanted to bring this slide in is what they call an E10AK blend, which is 10% ethanol and a biodiesel and some iso and some pentanes added. Now, that combination, as you see, is your highest mileage producer. So our combination of the ethanol industry and biodiesel is actually improving the mileage in the vehicles. But as E10 has been more and more spread across the country, the automobile industry is stepping up a little bit, and you'll see we're not getting very significant decreases in mileage. We're used to these top 3 to maybe 5%. Now you're talking an E10 blend, maybe a 1% drop, and some of these cars are basically the same mileage. And like I said, the best mileage producer was an E10 blend with some biodiesel and some pentanes. Next slide. And then this slide just compares to a cost per mile. And as your cost per mile goes down, your highest cost per mile is still in your unleaded, straight normal unleaded gas. And, of course, that E10 AK blend that I was showing you there is your lowest cost per mile. And there was no problems with any of these vehicles driving E10 or 20% blend or even a 30% blend. Actually, one member of the American Coalition of Ethanol has been running a regular non-E85 car with straight E85 ethanol in it, and now it's got close to 100,000 miles on that rig, and then American Coalition Ethanol is going to tear that down and see what kind of effects, if any, of his head on its engine. So a lot of people that I know back in the Midwest where there's E85 blends run up to 50% blends, even in non-E85 vehicles. And world ethanol production, of course, right now the U.S., Brazil is the biggest producer of ethanol, and they have been for a number of years. Their mandatory blend is 24 to 25% ethanol blend in the gas. Most of their cars that are coming off the line right now, whether it's a Volkswagen, Ford, or a GM, are either 100% alcohol to 100% unleaded, so they are a full-flex vehicle. In Brazil, they have roughly 31,000 petroleum stations there. 29,000 have an alcohol pump, so you can pump whatever you want. And the cars are developed there for either running 100% alcohol to 100% unleaded. You choose what you want to run in them or any percent thereof in the middle. In the U.S. now, we expect that in the next couple of years that the production of ethanol in the U.S. will outstrip Brazil. But to get to a full 10% blend, we would have to be at 14 billion gallons of ethanol. And most people expect that through grain we can only get to about 9 to 11 billion gallons. So the next big leap in ethanol production will, of course, come from cellulose ethanol. And that process is now becoming economically viable, where we'll turn both agricultural waste, you're talking wood waste, or even landfill material into ethanol. And they estimate that market could be as much as 20 billion in ethanol. So that is what we're going to need to get to
viable percentage of ethanol in gasoline and get us away from some of our dependence on petroleum. And here's one of the slides I put in. MTBE, we're now up to 25 states that have banned MTBE. Of course, that was the other additive that you could do for increasing oxygenate. There's about four more states that are in the process of banning that. In that biofuels legislation that we didn't get passed this year, we also had a ban in Oregon for MTBE. So that is one thing I do hope that we can get to in the next legislation, both the methanol blend and the ban on MTBE. Next one. So this is just some of the facts of the petroleum industry. Right now, in 2004, this is from American Petroleum Institute, they were 92.8% utilization of the refineries. So our refineries were running at full speed, and they were totally utilized. With the hurricanes, you'll probably see that utilization down this year just because of the currently under repairs down in the Gulf. And our imports of oil rose 4% to exceed 10 million barrels per day. And as far as product, over 10% grew to 10%. This is finished product, gas and diesel that has to come in fully refined because we do not have the capacity in the current system. That rose to 2.86 million barrels per year. In other words, we imported over 10 billion gallons last year of refined gasoline because we couldn't even refine it here. That would be much higher this year, and in that number is a lot of diesel gallons also that were brought in. Distillates rose, let's see, gasoline, our demand for it rose 1.3%, actually 1.8% is our 10-year average about how we increase every year to the 39 billion gallons, and our distillates are up 3.5%, of course, the ultra-low sulfur diesel is the one that's going to be growing the most. So our domestic crude production fell because of our accessibility to it, to our own stocks, dropped to 5.4 million barrels per day. So that is everything I have.
So we would like to have a little bit of time for Q&A. Our next panel is expected to start at 2:30, which means we only have 5 minutes, but we were running a little bit behind, so let's see how many questions there are. We've got our panelists, and if Mark Fitz is back up with us. So if you have a question, please raise your hand, maybe stand up and ask it very loudly. Over here.
Hi. I guess my question is for Brian, is it? Hi. You were addressing us on our conversions or how to use biodiesel in automobiles. I've heard very differing accounts of what damage can be caused to specifically fuel pumps in automobiles that are doing that conversion. I have a late model Jetta. I bought it. I started using B20 immediately in it. I'd like to use B100, but I don't. It's only warrantied for B5, and I don't want to incur a costly repair bill. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
That's a good question, and I get that question pretty frequently. First of all, no fuel is warrantied. So if you have bad fuel, any instance of bad fuel is not obviously going to be covered by the manufacturer. So secondly, question about does biodiesel more rapidly accelerate any sort of damage to your engine, and specifically to the fuel pump. I haven't come across a single instance. I've done a huge amount of research where a fuel pump failure can be directly attributed to biodiesel. I do know that there have been some fuel pumps, specifically in the TDIs, that have been a little weak in general. And in fact, I was just speaking about 3 months ago with a guy who does nothing but tear apart fuel system expert. He was really down on a couple of specific models of the TDI fuel pump and really was saying that he was working with Bosch, who was the manufacturer of them, to try and get them worked out as to what the issue was. But bottom line is I'm not aware of any at all actual cases of directly attributable engine damage to biodiesel. Now, if you do have a car that's on the way out and you put, you know, an older vehicle and it's all, the engine's already on the way out and you put biodiesel into it, it might accelerate that because you're cleaning out things and deposits may actually have been holding your engine together in a way. Does anyone want to add anything to that? Are you aware of any?
Star Oil is a valve line distributor. We got somewhere between 400 and 500 auto shops that we deal with, and I've gone out of my way to talk to those that work specifically on VW and Mercedes vehicles to tell us. And there's only one instance of all our customers and all these shops that have told us that they've had a biodiesel-related failure. And the guy started by bad-mouthing biodiesel because it smells so bad and refused to work on it because it doesn't smell as good as the diesel engines. And it was a return fuel line that failed because of the biodiesel in a VW TDI, which had a metal fuel line. So we have not seen it. If you've got a VW, I have a few shops I can recommend taking them to where you have an owner who is very pro-biodiesel, one in particular where the guy runs B99. And I believe VW allows certain shops that are certified to do warranty work, so you'd even have a very friendly environment to address your warranty issues. So,
next question from the woman at the camera.
Okay, I have two questions. One is for Mark Fitz, and it's regarding using B99 or 100% biodiesel in the a home heating fuel tank. If it's outside and you mentioned that it would gel, I was asking you just here on the sidelines if you could just drop a little electric heater into it. That submersible heater would be one thing. Or the last gentleman that spoke talked about mixing a little ethanol in to keep it from gelling. That's the first question I have. And then the second question I have is for Don Wysocki, and I wanted to know about hemp. So maybe I can redirect that once Mark's answered my question.
I don't know about the ethanol. I haven't seen research on that. There may be B99 winter treatment additives that they're promised to work. I don't know if they do or not, so that may solve that issue. I'll tell you, in Oregon, it's not a real big issue, though. If you if you just made sure whoever is your HVAC technician allowed for a draw that pulled the fuel from a little farther up than the bottom of the tank, which means you have to make sure you keep the tank full, but you'd be able to avoid gelling issues there. And they do make tank heaters for, I think, around $100 that you drop in off the top that heat, just put a little bit of heat in the fuel, which keeps the fuel moving around in a convection, which keeps it from gelling. So, yeah, that's what you do.
So, I'm wondering if you're listing those different oil crops that you mentioned hemp. I know that it's not yet viable in a certain way. If there was a reason that hemp was a high oil producer, would that be a viable option here? And I guess also, I want to caveat any type of question about using agricultural oil products and I think it means you can feel you could do a lot of value for food rather than oil production.
Let me answer that, the hemp question first. Since it's not a commercial seed, I have no idea where that would trade or what the oil content is. It is a potential oil seed crop. Currently, the political and the law enforcement laws regulate the growth of hemp. It's illegal, even the non-THC type, and for obvious reasons, because you can confuse the two. So, there's some political issues that you'd have to overcome to raise that crop. But it is a potential oil seed crop. I don't know how it would come out compared to these other major oil seeds. And the question about the grass seed, what was?
The question is, how are we going to convince farmers, I guess, that it from those oil companies and from lower gas column, because it's not going to harm people the way of pollen and you know, field burning and hopefully not.
Well, they, you know, their decision, what crops they grow, is basically an economic decision. And so if some of these other crops, potential crops, can produce equal or better income, you know, that's really the deciding factor. Depending on the crop, you know, just about every production crop we have has inputs of nitrogen and herbicides and other things. So if you substitute one crop for another, you may not achieve the goal of eliminating herbicides or pesticides because, you know, our production system depends on those crop protection type products.
Do we have time for just two more questions?
Two more questions? Is that what you said? Go ahead.
Hi, my question is about the energy costs associated with fuel production. I've read that the amount of energy it takes to produce a gallon of ethanol is actually more than the energy you get out of ethanol. So I'd like to hear from you about the ethanol question and also from the gentleman from Oregon State about how that relates to biodiesel. And also, I'm just curious about the energy costs of what it takes to produce a gallon of gasoline from a gallon of petroleum oil.
Okay, the current newest production facilities are about 170% effective. In other words, it takes 70% less energy that goes in to get ethanol out. When you take a look at natural gas, they're only about 80% effective. So that report comes from Pimentel, and I don't remember the name of this, the last guy. He's put out the report about every 4 or 5 years and kind of corresponds with when we're trying to get a renewable energy standard through. And a lot of people have said his findings are very flawed. He's one of the few reports that now even suggests that ethanol is not energy effective. And the other guy that he wrote a report with was a former Shell employee. So I guess I go with the reports that are out there that I say are credible. They show that ethanol is 134% in general, but when you take a look at just the new technology plants, they're up to 170% effective.
Don, did you want to add anything on energy content?
The number that Chuck just quoted, that I've read similar numbers, about 1.3% energy gain. And if you go to oil seeds, it's much higher than that. But, you know, there's also economics to deal with. Biodiesel, I think, has a life cycle analysis of about 3.2 energy gain. But, the energy input in crops or fertilizer, which comes from natural gas, it's the fuel direct fuel consumption for running your tractors. So the energy inputs in your crop protection products that go in, and you know those are the major energy inputs, is other than what's consumed on the farm are those products, rubber, in the so in life cycle analysis, we're on oils, it's about 3.2.
Great. Okay, one more question.
Okay, my one question is going to be two questions. Sorry. First question is, I recently converted my car to run on B99. I'm aware of the fuel system filter issues and the hose issues. All that is fine. I did read, though, that the Washington State Ferries had stopped using biodiesel because they were experiencing bacteria growth in their fuel systems. And I wanted to find out from you whether or not I should be adding a biocide to my tank to prevent that from happening, if there is something that's compatible with biodiesel. And the second question is, do you see any other alternatives coming on the forefront for gasoline-powered vehicles as far as a sustainable fuel that could be used in gasoline-powered cars?
Thomas, do you want to, or Brian?
Okay, the situation with the ferries is a very specific marine situation. I actually started using biodiesel first in a sailboat, and the the situation that you have to worry about in a marine environment is not the same as in an automobile. So basically, it has to do with condensation that forms in the tank, and when you're in a marine environment, the differences in temperature are very great. So you have water that builds up in your fuel tank, and that condensation leads to a growth of bacteria. This is also an issue with diesel as well. It's not strictly a biodiesel issue. There's actually little guys that live in diesel. So it's a big worry if you have a boat. It is not a worry if you have a vehicle. So take care of that one. Do you want to
finish a second? Boats have bacterial issues with petroleum diesel, so it's nothing new. The big issue is, of course, you have these huge tanks and temperature changes, and if you're not checking for water, you're going to have real issues. You also have a different filtration system you have on your car, and you have a much smaller tank that you turn over probably every week to 2 weeks. So you shouldn't have the same issues, but if you want to treat it a biocide, we'll work on a biodiesel just like a standard diesel.
You also had a question about whether there were any other fuels that could be used in gasoline engines. Ethanol really is the substitute for gasoline. But then we've got biodiesel as the substitute for diesel. Then you have more fuel-efficient cars, basically that idea of conserving the fuel, so hybrid electric engines. Maybe hydrogen down the road, but those are really the basic ones. You can also convert to compressed natural gas. So that's what's out there now. Who knows what the future holds? But I wanted to take time to thank our panelists, fantastic group of people.
We're going to take just a 5-minute recess to change over our panel. But again, I did want to thank Mitchell Hartman, Paul Needham, Mark Fitz, Brian Jameson. I'm so bad at Don Hartowski, Thomas Endicott, and Chuck Carlson all for being part of our panel here today. Thank you. We'll be back in 5 minutes. Restrooms, in case you're curious, back there, through those doors, and then back past the...